loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk with co-host Brian Becker, who is in Singapore this week for the historic summit between U.S. leader Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. We'll discuss his expectations and share an interview from another journalist who is also on the ground there. Brian will be coming to you straight from Singapore this week with in-person analysis of this historic summit, so tune in at the top of the hour for Singapore coverage. And then, the G7 summit in Canada last weekend ended in a major public dispute between Donald Trump and the other six leaders, driven by the administration's protectionist trade measures. Meanwhile, protesters and heavily militarized police faced off in Quebec City.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Federal Communications Commission's repeal of net neutrality is official today. It had required internet service providers to offer equal access to all web content, but now providers can censor online content or they can charge you extra for better service. Next, the Supreme Court ruled today that voter rolls can be cleared for those who are inactive for a certain amount of time based on a case in Ohio. How will this kind of voter suppression affect people nationwide? Then today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then today we have another weekly segment called Connected Lives, Private Profits with Chris Garaffa. Chris will help us look at technological issues that shape our world and how we can fight to maintain our civil rights and civil liberties in the face of increasingly advanced and sometimes hostile technology. And finally, Pablo Villavicencio, an undocumented father of two in New York City, was delivering food to an army base outside of the city when he was stopped by a guard who then called ICE and had him arrested. The fight to save him from deportation has become a national flashpoint as the Trump administration's hardline anti-immigrant policies come under increasing fire. And in other headlines, the U.S. Treasury Department unveiled new sanctions today targeting Russia. Five companies and three individuals were targeted for allegedly providing equipment to the country's main intelligence agency, the FSB, which then used these products to carry out cyber attacks. Despite the Russiagate allegations, the Trump administration has steadily introduced new sanctions and other measures targeting Russia since assuming office. Spain on Monday offered to take in a humanitarian ship stranded in international waters with 629 refugees aboard, including 134 children and seven pregnant women, as the new Italian government and Malta refused to let it dock. Spain's new socialist prime minister, Pedro Sanchez, said he will allow the ship to dock in Valencia. The ongoing refugee crisis in the European Union has led to intense debate and strain within the alliance. A suicide car bombing in Kabul, Afghanistan, targeting a government building, has caused at least 12 deaths and 30 injuries today. This comes despite a historic three-day ceasefire announced by the Taliban and the government to mark the end of Ramadan. So far, no group has claimed responsibility for the attack, and ISIS in Afghanistan is not part of the ceasefire. The White House's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, has insisted that the Trump administration will not unilaterally pull out of the NAFTA trade agreement. Kudlow said, quote, "We are heavy into negotiations," but added, quote, "I don't know if negotiators will reach a deal because I think, again, Trudeau's very unfortunate statements, his betrayal, he betrayed Trump," unquote. Kudlow was referencing the dispute at the G7 summit in Quebec. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion about the upcoming Trump-Kim summit in Singapore. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the historic Trump-Kim summit in Singapore. We're joined from Singapore by Brian Becker, who's there to cover the summit. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So tell us, what exactly is going to be happening? The summit starts at 9 p.m. East Coast United States time today, which is 9 a.m. Singapore time. You're there with the Sputnik News team to cover the summit. Who exactly will be talking to each other? Of course, Trump and Kim will be part of that. But what about other members of the delegations from the various governments?
Well, we're sort of basing our understanding on leaks to the media. So some of what I think is going to happen may be altered by what actually happens. But what we're hearing is that there will be at least two meetings tomorrow, and no one knows for certain how long this summit is going to last. It's supposed to be a one-day affair It may be a half a day affair. It may be 2 or 3 days. We just don't know. But what we do think is going to happen is that tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. here in Singapore, again, as you said, 9 p.m. East Coast time in Washington, D.C., Donald Trump is going to meet with Kim Jong-un one-on-one. The only other people in the room are going to be translators. That's, of course, a very historic event because no U.S. head of state has met a North Korean head of state. And the fact that the two of them are going to meet without advisors present, at least for the first hour and perhaps the first 2 hours, is also, I would say, somewhat unorthodox in terms of a negotiating posture. After that first meeting, apparently both teams will be, both national security teams will be joining their respective head of state. So in the case of Donald Trump, he would be joined by Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, and perhaps General John Kelly, who is the Chief of Staff for the Trump White House. There will be a comparable team joining Kim Jong-un from North Korea. So that's what we're hearing, at least, a two-part meeting. Again, there's lots of rumors. You know, Donald Trump had said in the beginning he'll know within the first minute whether or not this is going to work. And then the media heard reports, and I believe this was probably leaked from the DPRK side, that they are scheduled to leave Singapore at 2 p.m. tomorrow, meaning just 5 hours after the summit is scheduled to start. Perhaps they're signaling back to Donald Trump that they might, too, be willing to make a quick judgment if they think things are not going well. So, of course, everything is up in the air. We don't really know what's going to happen, but we do know that the two leaders are going to meet and that in and of itself is a historic development.
Brian, the press here this morning has had a very different take on things amongst themselves. I made a point to watch bits of all of the morning shows today. MSNBC is saying that people who are there at the summit today are present at the destruction of American foreign policy. That's what they're calling it, the destruction of American foreign policy because of this summit. CNN is saying that the president is capitulating to a madman and is endangering U.S. national security. Fox, of course, says that this is an historic moment and there's, for the very first time, the real possibility of peace between the United States and North Korea. What's the mood on the ground there in Singapore where you are? How are people treating this thing?
John Kiriakou, I am so glad you asked me that question because I was struck too. I'm here in a hotel right now and I'm watching MSNBC and Fox and CNN and the media reports are either just the way you describe them, that the sky is falling, that something very terrible is about to happen, that the international order is about to be undone because Donald Trump is meeting with Kim Jong-un, or the reports are focused on what happened in Quebec and how Donald Trump is having a kerfuffle with Justin Trudeau as if that's something that may, in fact, alter world history. Here in Singapore, where, you know, I was at the press center today, the International Media Center, there's 2,500 journalists here. Almost all of them, I'm not joking, almost all of them are from Asian countries, from Southeast Asia, from the Asia Pacific. There's a sense of enthusiasm. There's a sense of excitement. There's a sense of expectation. And there's a sense that this is, in fact, the most important thing happening in the world today because, of course, Asia has suffered so much. There was the Korean War. 4 million Koreans died. The Vietnam War. 3 to 4 million Vietnamese died. There was, you know, 100 years ago, the Filipino War when the United States invaded the Philippines. 1 million Filipinos died. During World War II, China probably lost as many as the Soviet Union lost. You know, somewhere between 25 and 35 million. The issue of war and peace is not abstract. It's front and center. You just get a sense when you're here in Singapore in a setting like this about how sort of Eurocentric or America-centric or Western-centric or imperialist-centric the media coverage is about all of world events, including this important world event. Far, far different feeling here on the ground in Singapore.
Brian, members of the Trump administration have been issuing this demand so frequently that they've come up with an acronym for it, CVID, Complete Verifiable Irreversible Denuclearization. Do you think that's a demand that's being made in good faith, or is it an attempt by elements of the U.S. military and foreign policy establishment who are opposed to the talks in the first place to put out an impossible demand as a way to sabotage the negotiations themselves?
Well, you know, when John Bolton and Mike Pence and some other pundits, and of course the neocon Washington Post and the New York Times, were echoing just that formulation, the North Koreans made it crystal clear that that was unacceptable. They were not coming to Singapore to surrender. They were not coming to disarm themselves as Gaddafi disarmed himself in Libya without anything in exchange. I think that point on the agenda is off the agenda. Let's put it that way. I think that was a fantasy. I don't think the North Koreans were going to fall for that. And I think Donald Trump, by his utterances of the last few days, has made it really, really obvious that that's no longer the negotiating position of the United States, because that would be impossible. What Donald Trump is now saying is that this is going to be is going to be the beginning of a process. It's going to take a while. He's not making these kind of unilateral demands on North Korea, because of course North Korea is prepared to walk away from that. North Korea has made 4 unilateral concessions: a moratorium on its nuclear weapons test, a moratorium on missile technology tests, a moratorium, the destruction of its nuclear test site, and the unilateral release of 3 Korean Americans who had been detained in North Korean prisons. That's 4 things they've done already. They're now looking, as they made it quite clear in their earlier communiques from today and yesterday, North Korea is looking to see whether or not Donald Trump is prepared to shift, change, alter the U.S. policy towards North Korea, to end the policy of hostility, to begin the process of normalizing relations. And when you read their communication, denuclearization comes number 3, third after those first 2 things. They want to see whether or not the U.S. is making a change in its policy.
We're talking with Brian Becker. He is the host of this show, of course, but this week he is in Singapore covering the Trump-Kim summit. Brian, you were able to do an interview a little bit earlier today. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was at, as I mentioned, at the International Media Center, 2,500 journalists, most of them people from Asia, most of them Asian people. But I talked to Niall Bowie, who is in fact a reporter for the Asia Times. And the thing that I wanted to focus in was, what's the impact of this kind of summit negotiations and diplomacy for Singapore itself? Singapore, of course, is pro-American. It's been part of a Western alliance, but it's been tilting also towards China. It can't ignore China. And certainly the fact that Singapore is hosting this summit has profound implications for its own orientation. So I talked to Niall Bowie about what this means for Singapore and for Southeast Asia. Let's take a listen.
And now we're going to be talking with Niall Bowie. He's a journalist with Asia Times. We're here, Niall, in the International Media Center in Singapore. Donald Trump, in his most recent tweet, said he's arrived and excitement is building. I don't think that, in fact, is an exaggeration. You've been here. You're living in Singapore. How does this impact people here, and how does it impact the government?
Well, the mood ahead of this summit is one of great anticipation. Everyone is waiting with bated breath, looking, watching the news as it comes in. Everyone is extremely curious. We've seen the two leaders arrive yesterday, and you saw tourists and locals gather outside the two hotels where the leaders are staying to try and catch a glimpse of the action. So there's a lot of excitement. Singapore is a city-state in Southeast Asia that often plays host to multilateral events and high-level meetings. It annually hosts the Shangri-La Dialogue, where many of the world's defense ministers come in. It regularly hosts meetings of groupings like APEC and ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And it is considered a relatively neutral player in Southeast Asia.
Well, let me just ask you, it's neutral, but it's been considered a pro-Western government, and certainly even a pro-American government. The government in Singapore was very much on board with the Trans-Pacific Partnership that President Obama championed and put a lot of capital in, and something that Donald Trump blew up, canceled immediately, one of his first acts coming into office. How did Singapore react to Donald Trump, and what does it mean for him to be here now?
Right. So if we consider Southeast Asian countries and their security and strategic orientation, these are small countries sandwiched between large powers. China is one of the key economic players in the region in all countries, and the United States has and always has historically had, since the Second World War, a large security presence in the Pacific. So as you mentioned, Singapore is generally in line with the strategic U.S. orientation. It does host some U.S. military vessels, the U.S. operations in the South China Sea, spying, you know, planes and whatnot. Those operations are conducted in Singapore, and there are very, very close ties. And Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong is arguably one of the most pro-American in his political orientation. Leader, you know, all around.
Was he upset or surprised by the election of Donald Trump?
Well, there's no doubt that Singapore, as many countries were, they were expecting a Hillary Clinton victory. The prime minister of the country gave very guarded interviews before the election took place, but he generally thought that it would be a win for Hillary, and she'd have to sort of walk back some of the rhetoric that she had, you know, criticism of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And another aspect of Singapore is that it was one of the countries that was heavily lobbying the United States government and the Obama administration to go ahead with it, to pass it as soon as possible, because it's key to the Asia pivot and the U.S. strategic position
in Asia.
Well,
let me just real quickly ask you about that. The Asia pivot was announced by President Obama in Australia in 2011. There was a kind of a feeling at that time that the Obama administration had a geostrategic reorientation. Instead of being bogged down in the Middle East while China ascended, at least in the Asia Pacific, that the United States was going to compete directly with China. China perceived that as a containment strategy. Obama said the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, guaranteed that America would write the rules of the road for international trade as it pertains to this area where 50% of the world's trade goes through. Singapore was on board with that. China perceived that as a direct challenge to China. Now, Donald Trump blew that up, as I said in the beginning. That dashed what I would think would be Singapore's expectations. At the same time, China has its own Belt and Road Initiative trying to integrate Asia, Southeast Asia, and Europe into one sort of economic entity through Belt and Road. How is it shaping up now?
Well, as you mentioned, the Asia pivot never really got off the ground. The U.S. is still bogged down in the Middle East, and the main economic component of the pivot, which is the TPP, was you know, axed. So since Trump came into office, the Singapore government has been trying to court him and trying to be as friendly as possible.
How do they do that?
When Lee Hsien Loong went to the United States late last year, he purchased aircraft for Singapore Airlines.
A favor for Donald Trump. Let me buy some
things,
American aircraft.
Certain things that he can say to boost his, you know, his position. Singapore already has a deficit. It has a trading surplus with the United States, so it wasn't targeted for any trade related reasons. And Lee Hsien Loong is generally on good terms with Donald Trump, and I think he was very much keen to just ensure that U.S.-Singapore ties would be on an even keel and steady going forward. So I see this summit, now it's Donald Trump's first trip to Singapore, as a way for the city-state to build influence, to be familiar, you know, with the Trump administration. For Donald Trump, who I don't believe has ever been to Singapore, he's landed here, it's a real place now. I think he'll be impressed with the organization, the planning, I mean, of the summit, and the cordiality of the Singapore position on this. And, you know, for a country that's very small, half the size of New York City, with no natural resources, diplomacy, the ability to hold big high security venues like this, and I did say relative political neutrality. So the Singapore has had it does have an independent posture on issues, and its views, to be fair, are very nuanced when you listen to their strategic explanations of things. And Lee Hsien Loong is widely regarded as a pretty wise reader of the geopolitics of the region. So back in the 1967, it was when North Korea first recognized Singapore. The two established ties, diplomatic ties, in 1975, and those ties have continued. I wouldn't say they're very deep, but there was until Singapore abided by UN Security Council sanctions and ceased all trade. There was a small trade relationship.
Singaporean foreign minister just got back from North Korea. He said a lot of good things about North Korea.
Right.
Were you surprised?
I was surprised. Normally, we see high-level diplomats, when they do go to Pyongyang, I think their feedback is a bit tempered. In a sense, I mean, this was one of the most glowing accounts of Pyongyang in terms of...
From the Singapore foreign minister.
From Vivian Balakrishnan, the foreign minister of Singapore. He went there. He said it's a gleaming green modern city with enormous potential. He spoke about when UN sanctions are dropped, there'll be enormous opportunities.
Well, that has to be music to the ears of the North Koreans, because it seems to me, Niall, that Donald Trump is now acknowledging this is going to be a long-term process. The main sort of measure of success would be if the process continues. From the point of view of the DPRK, it would seem to me that they don't really fully expect a security guarantee from Washington. I mean, when you look at Libya, when you look at the Iran deal, you wouldn't have any expectation of that. But what they really want to do is change the international climate so that countries like Singapore or countries like China or Russia, and of course China and Russia share a big border, in the case of China, a 900-mile-long border with DPRK. If those countries start to do trade with DPRK, and if DPRK is sort of enters into a China-led globalization, unlike the American-led globalization, that might be the DPRK's bottom line.
I think that is definitely the trajectory where this is heading. Ultimately, as you said, the North Koreans are going to these talks. They've seen the U.S. in recent months pull out of the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. They, of course, don't trust the Trump administration to give a sincere security guarantee. And I think as a result of the last few months' diplomatic engagements on the part of Kim Jong-un, his view has changed. His diplomatic stature has changed. He's met with top world leaders. He's met with diplomats. And I think his perceptions of him, even in South Korea, have changed dramatically. And what I feel is that this is going to lead towards, as you mentioned, this new situation where countries see North Korea as acting in goodwill and trying to promote a solution. And accordingly, countries like Russia and China will open and expand their trade relations with North Korea.
Niall Bowie is our guest. We're talking to him from the International Media Center here in Singapore on the eve of the Donald Trump Kim Jong-un summit, which will take place tomorrow beginning at 9 a.m. Singapore time. Let's go back again, because Singapore, like many countries in Southeast Asia, is in the same neighborhood as China. And of course, the same neighborhood is the DPRK. Singapore, like other countries in Southeast Asia, is playing something of a balancing act. China is clearly rising as a major economic power. It's trying to develop both regional and bilateral relations with the other countries in this region. And certainly, it would seem to me that the United States, or at least some parts of the U.S. media, are speculating that maybe there will be a grand bargain where Donald Trump will cement a new relationship with the North Korean government and do what Richard Nixon did to China, which was to break China away from its historic relationship with the Soviet Union and lead to an anti-Soviet alliance. Could North Korea be, wooed into some sort of anti-China alliance? In my mind, and again, I'm you know, I'm not an expert here. I don't speak the languages here. But it seems to be a kind of wishful thinking. I'm just looking at a New York Times article from this morning that speculates just that. But the DPRK media, the official media, just reported that Kim Jong-un arrived here on a Chinese plane. I mean, that was the first sentence of the DPRK communique. What do you think?
I absolutely think it is wishful thinking. It's frankly very silly. We do see the beginnings or what look like indications of North Korea attempting to make a strategic reorientation to put the economic development of the country at the forefront of its policy. And I think since Kim Jong-un has been in power, he has always emphasized the importance of developing North Korea's economy. Whether that I seriously doubt, given the optics of the meetings that Kim Jong-un has had with Xi Jinping, the level of relations that the two sides have had, true that things were a little frosty in recent years. As we discussed before, Russia and China had essentially sided with the U.S. that it was North Korea's responsibility to denuclearize and what have you. And as a result, China has stuck to its guns on UN sanctions, and no doubt those sanctions are starting to bite. However, we see the warm relationship between Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un. We see that the high, the geographic proximity, the economic, I don't know, dependency, but of course, China is regarded as a lifeline for North Korea, economically speaking. So the idea that North Korea would be peeled off into some sort of alliance to be a spear in China's side in all this, I think it goes totally against the trend of the region, which is China building up parallel institutions such as the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, various...
Because we only have a couple minutes left, let me ask you real quick. The Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank, AIIB, major financing operation that, whereby China challenges Western credit sources. Even some of the key U.S. NATO allies, maybe all of them at this point, have joined against the demands of the Obama administration earlier. Singapore is part of this?
Yes, it was among the founding members, I believe. I have to check on that, but I believe it was. It is positioning itself, Singapore is positioning itself to be one of the financing capitals for various infrastructure projects associated with the Belt and Road Initiative. Just nearby, Malaysia is one of the main recipients of infrastructure projects in line with the Belt and Road, and across the region, Chinese ties with countries like Brunei, with Thailand, they are in the ascent. And we could look at a country like Singapore and other Southeast Asian countries, and what they have traditionally done, I mean in a nutshell, is side with China on economic matters and basically hedge with the U.S. on security matters. And potentially this could be changing, especially as there are no economic incentives on offer from Washington. There are no forthcoming trade agreements. And frankly, the countries in the region are very much flustered by Donald Trump's recent G7 summit appearance and generally his trade policy orientation and philosophy. They're very much flustered by the disruptive character. And all these economies being very open and trade reliant, they do stand to gain if there's a trade war. So if there is a trade war, I think it's very much in the cards that these countries may accelerate their ties and relationship with China.
That was the voice of journalist Niall Bowie, who was interviewed by Brian Becker, co-host of Loud and Clear, who is in Singapore this week covering the Trump-Kim summit. Brian, in the last 2 minutes that we have left in this segment, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, are we looking at a historic agreement coming out of this summit, or do you think this is going to be the beginning of a longer process?
Well, I think there's a couple issues. One is, how do we define success for this summit, and what's the ultimate objective here? From the point of view of the North Koreans, the objective is to have an improved relations, normalized relations with the United States, which could be signaled by certain lifting of economic sanctions or a peace treaty. They want to do that before they are going to give up their nuclear weapons. From the point of view of the United States, I think Donald Trump really needs the summit to be successful. He's beset by domestic political problems. What does it mean now for Donald Trump? He's lowered expectations. Success for Donald Trump means that this summit came out good enough to continue the process. In other words, getting ready for another summit. And the word here on the street is that if all goes well tomorrow, if there's a sort of an agreement in principle that this process is going forward, there will be a follow-up summit, and perhaps it will be in Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea. So success really means, in this case, not the end of the process, but allowing a process to keep going. In other words, the beginning of a process rather than the termination of a process. A lot's at stake right now. A lot of people are holding their breath. A lot of fingers are crossed. But that's what success means, is does the process continue? And ultimately, success means this. Will the United States begin to have normalized diplomatic relations with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea? Will they exchange embassies? Will they exchange ambassadors? Will they have a normal relationship rather than the relationship of two parties who are still at war? That's the big question.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. We've been joined from Singapore by Brian Becker, co-host of Loud and Clear, who is on the scene at the historic Trump-Kim summit there. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.
All eyes are set at the summit between the U.S. and North Korean leader to take place. While the outcomes that have been forecasted are all speculations at this point, the U.S. has made its position somewhat clear. Complete and verifiable and irreversible denuclearization and no economic relief. Well, in this edition of the debate, we will look at the possible scenarios that may evolve out of this meeting and look at the role that China is playing in these negotiations. Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, former American intelligence linguist Scott Rickert joins us from St. Petersburg. And we have former Pentagon official Michael Maloof, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome you both. Michael Maloof, let me start with you. This is a historic summit set to take place, the first meeting between U.S. and North Korean leaders. Isn't that largely because previous U.S. presidents have balked at giving Pyongyang regime such recognition?
Well, they haven't really followed through on any of the stipulations that they made, and in the meantime, North Korea went ahead with its nuclear and missile development programs. But this is different. Kim Jong-un wants something in return, and that is survival. And I think that he would not have been as forthcoming as he is beginning to display now, unless he had some assurances, not just from the United States, which is being questioned because of what happened on the JCPOA or the Iranian nuclear agreement and the pullout. But I think China has also given him security assurances of survival, and because it's in China's interest that they do not want a nuclear peninsula, number one. But number two, they want that buffer. They want North Korea to remain as a buffer against Western influence. And I think that because of Trump's personal relationship with Xi Jinping, the president of China, I think some accommodation is probably going to be forthcoming. So it's not going to be something that can be arrived at just by a Trump-Kim summit, although that's going to take time. But also, I think China is going to be weighing in. Out of all of this, you're not going to have a total agreement on denuclearization. I think that there's going to be some question of definition of denuclearization, because each side has a different perspective. But out of it could come an armistice, which would settle the Korean War. And that would in itself be monumental. But at the same time, I think that is ultimately going to be rolled in to an overarching agreement between North Korea and the United States.
Well, there are different important points that Michael Maloof made there, Scott Rickert. Let me first start with one thing which from the beginning I'm going to get into, and that is the role that China has played. How much of an influence do you think China has had on North Korea going into the talks, and how these talks are going to develop? Of course, that's purely speculation at this point.
Well, I agree with Michael on that point as well. Obviously, when it comes to China's done a fantastic job at negotiating agreements with North Korea in the past, and certainly the move with North Korea and South Korea has shown great promise. I see this meeting with Trump being more symbolic. Obviously, it's nothing as significant as, say, Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev when they met in Reykjavik almost just over 30 years ago. You have a different kind of relationship here between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. This is a very symbolic meeting. You've had two leaders of nations threatening each other through their respective press outlets. And at the same time, you've had very reasonable types of negotiations coming out of China and significantly South Korea as well. Donald Trump is obviously leading the largest military in the world that's been threatening and occupies the south part of South Korea. And in the United States has also obviously sanctioned North Korea for over six decades, which it, by far is the longest sanction period in the history of modern times. Trade is very important to the development of a nation. And I think China has basically said, look, we're going to open up trade. We're going to help you develop your country. You know, go ahead and stand down with the Americans and work something out. And I think that we may see something significant and historical out of this, but not because of Donald Trump. But I believe that the Chinese and the South Koreans have paved the way and obviously given Donald Trump an easy way out. Now, can he ruin it? Obviously, yes. We have a very insignificant leader in the United States at this moment, and certainly his ego can supersede any kind of reasonable negotiation at this point.
Michael Maloof, how much of a factor do you think the issues that are between the U.S. and China factor in the way that these negotiations perhaps might go? Because it begs for some type of wheeling and dealing to go on behind the scenes when it comes to the spats that the U.S. has with China, such as trade deal, such as the South China Sea.
Well, it's no accident that Trump reversed himself on the ZTE sanctions. That basically would have killed the company. And it's a major, major telecommunications company in China. And you'll notice that it came just before this summit was announced. Otherwise, I think China would have been much more recalcitrant and less cooperative and wouldn't have cared as much to see this this particular session between Trump and Kim a success. However, with that done, there's certainly still trade issues between the United States and China, but ZTE was the the biggest, and they've worked out something, and that's good. And I think that what you're going to be seeing here is Trump. So these discussions, if you read Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, Chapter 2, called The Elements of the Deal, you see where he is in his various negotiating phases. He's now not only in the leverage, he's gone beyond the leveraging level and now is in trying to come up with a negotiation. Well, he said he ultimately wants denuclearization. He's going to get it eventually, but he's willing to settle for elements that lead up to it. I think this first meeting, even though it's going to be for a few hours, is to set a framework for future discussions, but I think that they're going to have to be, but China is going to be watching this very closely, and you're going to have China's interest in that. Will China be needed in ultimately signing an armistice? Yes, because there is the six power agreement that was arrived at some time ago, and China ultimately will be involved in that. But at least they can agree that they want to sign an armistice as a first step, and I think that will go, that in and of itself would be major, major development.
Well, one of the things that Michael Maloof said, Scott Rickard, is the definition of denuclearization, one in which North Korea might have an idea of that is somewhat different than what the U.S. might think of, or maybe a lot different by some accounts. One of them being the time frame of what denuclearization might take. What is the definition of denuclearization that perhaps both that might be compatible to both sides?
Well, obviously, from the U.S. perspective, they'd like to see a complete weapons denuclearization of North Korea. Certainly from an energy perspective, I would expect North Korea to be able to retain that type of nuclear capability. So that would be the extent at which we may see an agreement. But at this point, if you look at the relationships between North Korea and the United States, obviously those relationships have been extremely tense with the occupation of South Korea and the development of South Korea by the West and their economic warfare against the North. I think one of the main benefits to North Korea is to end the economic sanctions, open up trade, and develop their society to an extent with the help of the Chinese. That would be a magnificent event that could come of this. Obviously, in the first meeting, it will be seen most likely as a failure because there's not very much you can do in the first meeting, but very much like Gorbachev, when he met with Reagan, they considered that a failure. But a year or two later, things did begin to work out. At the end of the day, unfortunately, the CIA had a lot of operations in Russia that I would warn the North Koreans to be very wise and be very careful of any relationships with the United States because of the past of the United States and how they will operate surreptitiously in North Korea given the opportunity. So, if there are openings like that, be very cautious of welcoming in the United States and ultimately the CIA.
Got to ask this question, Michael Maloof, and that is the Iran nuclear deal and whether that plays a factor in this whole thing. Because obviously North Korea has to take that into account going into this into these talks. And Kim Jong-un must be quite reserved, if not doubtful, whether the sincerity exists from the U.S., especially of a president who, aside from the JCPOA, has pulled out of numerous other deals. How much of a factor will that play in the way the decision-making body of his team takes place in Singapore?
Well, I think it's a serious consideration. Now, you got to keep in mind, though, that the JCPOA was only an agreement among nations. I think the answer to that, to deal with that, because of the security guarantees that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, wants to provide to North Korea, they ought to make whatever agreement that they come up with a treaty. Let Congress weigh in, and that makes it much more difficult for the U.S. to unilaterally pull out. Once it's a treaty, that's a little different than just an agreement in which Trump demonstrated you can just walk away from it. Now, but having said that, I think the JCPOA walk away was a watershed moment, and that is going to create other issues beyond North Korea. It's going to basically result in a much more multipolar world order that's going to be emerging, particularly in light of the SCO, the Eurasia, European Union, the Belt Road Initiative. All of those things coming together, plus Trump's basic war on EU allies, European Union allies on trade issues that could rent asunder any agreement we've had going back 50 years. So we're seeing something evolving here. We're seeing something because of that moment when Trump dropped out of the JCPOA that we're going to be seeing much greater developments on the international scene and much more of a multipolar approach as opposed to the unilateral or the unipolar U.S.-led world order that we've seen heretofore.
Well, both sides, Scott Rickard, have their advisors, have their members that are going to be involved in the negotiations. But in particular, let me start with the U.S. side. I mean, you have some divergence when it comes to views from, for example, John Bolton compared to Michael Pompeo. And of course, the U.S. president himself, who says, I'm going to know within the first minute whether Kim Jong-un is serious or not.
Well, yeah, seriously, when you're thinking about Bolton and Pompeo as advisors, let's be clear here that this is a very large group of Americans that they represent. The 70-plus million evangelical Christians in the United States are really the base of these extremist American advisors. I would consider Pompeo and Bolton extremist advisors, to any administration, certainly in the past and certainly right now. When it comes to obviously Donald Trump, you know, this is a very immature, obviously egotistical, pathological liar who has, you know, assumed the presidency of the United States through his relationships, albeit very nefarious along the way. And this is a, you know, a very sad day in the history of the United States, whereby our leadership has gone so far down so many paths on the Democratic Party side and the Republican Party sides. These are very sad days. When you look at the history of the American political infrastructure, it's been extremely manipulated by foreign policy invaders, particularly the pro-Israel Zionists that are heavily represented by the 70 plus million evangelicals. So when you talk about the individuals that are representing the United States at these types of negotiations, these aren't representative of any kind of reasonable individuals in the United States. These are representative of very unreasonable individuals who have a heuristic thinking that's been imposed upon them by a doctrine that's come out of modifications to Bibles and modifications to political and religious infrastructures over the past 100 years. So I think we're living in dangerous times with these kinds of individuals in place, and certainly do not trust any treaties, any negotiations, or any types of agreements that are made with the United States, because they've proven over and over again with the indigenous American Indians, as well as other treaties around the world, that they will not be trusted.
Well, Michael Maloof, I know this is speculation, but one of the things that I'm guessing, and your view matters here, is sanctions relief. I'm guessing that North Korea wants sanctions relief, or a promise of it, or some suggestion of it somewhere rather quickly. But Michael Pompeo came out and said that if we don't get denuclearization settled, quote, if diplomacy does not move in the right direction, those measures will increase. Do you think there's going to be sanctions relief suggestions somewhere at a minimum, so that North Korea at least has an incentive to go along with these talks?
I think eventually you'll see some form of sanctions relief. It's not going to be I don't believe it will be from this initial meeting. This is going to be much more of a get acquainted, and I think if there's a show of freezing and on the part of North Korea, you may be of its freezing of its development programs and nuclear and missile development programs, you may begin to see something beginning, but certainly nothing wholesale. And as Pompeo said, if they go along with his definition, if the North Koreans go along with his definition of denuclearization, then everything's going to spring eternal for North Korea. I think there could be a possibility out of all this, even with the realization that they're not going to have immediate denuclearization, that at least you have an opening, and there's, I think conceivably you could see an opening of certain relationships, diplomatic relationships, that could begin to lay a foundation, and maybe along with that might be some sanctions relief, but certainly not in the end. If you're going to be doing the hard line, as Trump likes to display, just as he did in the G7 toward the allies, he's going to hold firm, I think, for a while yet, but at least leave the door open for that possibility. Now, if they have an argument and dislike each other immediately, Trump has already made the point, he's walking out. That can be a real problem, and sanctions will just go up. But I think both sides are trying to make the best of this situation. They both realize the historical significance of it. It's the first time a president of the United States has ever met with the leadership of North Korea. So I think there's a lot at stake here, notwithstanding other things that Trump has done around the world.
Okay, and since we're drawing to a close here, I'll give you a last question, Scott Rickard. What if these talks fail? What's next?
Well, I mean, obviously, there are no more sanctions that can be imposed on North Korea. This is a country that's been under the worst sanctions in the history of modern times. Certainly, China will step in, and obviously, the rest of the world will not allow the U.S. to increase any kind of sanctions. But at the end of the day, you know, obviously, Iran is a great example. If there are any promises of relieving sanctions, you might want to be cautious again to believe those promises of relieving sanctions. Iran's been betrayed by the JCPOA on a number of occasions, and the spirit of the agreement's been violated over and over. So unfortunately, no matter what good comes up out of these negotiations, be very wary of the actual agreements that are made, that they will probably be broken based upon past experiences and what we've seen the United States and their agreements.
Thank you very much. We're going to end with our former American intelligence linguist Scott Rickard there and former Pentagon official Michael Maloof. Thank you for your comments from Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate.
Pleasure.
From Mikhail Vitovy and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
La la la.